history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories to tell, if we only take the time to ask and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, along this journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we're going to hear today is pretty intriguing, from back in the World War II era and even in recent years, some adventures that Ed Larson has had. He is the author of a nice thick book called Spear Carrier in a Backwater War. And we're going to come to understand a little bit of what that means with 91-year-old Ed Larson of Santa Cruz, California, but originally from Seattle, Washington. What do you remember about those early years in Seattle? You grown up with basically a single mother and your grandparents?
A great place to grow up. Seattle was a wonderful town. It's changed tremendously, of course, through the years. But with the sound, Puget Sound around, the opportunity for boating and all that type of activity was just great. My birth father was a pilot, and my mother related stories that he had told her. He left the scene when I was about a year old. I'd describe him as an itinerant saxophone player, tap dancer, and airplane pilot. He was a nice guy, but no sense of responsibility that was lasting at all, and he never changed in the course of his life. We remained friends, but we didn't see each other too often. But Boeing Field was kind of a mecca for me as I grew up. My grandparents and my mother used to take me down to Boeing's because I just loved the airplanes, and it was kind of a romantic place. There were a few military aircraft there then, and it was pretty primitive, but it was a great place to learn about flying. And the first time I ever flew, my dad took me up in an Aronca C-3, which I've described as kind of a cross between a tennis racket and a croquet mallet. It was a little dinky thing with a motorcycle engine in it. When my mother found out he'd taken me up, she went wild. But it was, I was hooked the minute I left the ground. My interest in aviation continued through elementary school. I illustrated a lot of airplanes, and I've been in art most of my life with a small amount of talent as far as drawing is concerned. I learned about the planes, and the affection kind of stuck through high school. And then when Pearl Harbor came along, there seemed to be only one logical place for me to be, and that would have been in the Air Force. I first tried to get into the Navy Air Force and made the mistake at the last instant of stating that I'd had some hay fever, and that threw me out of the Navy Air Force. So I went down the block and signed up for the Army Air Force and kept my mouth shut, which was a wise thing to do. Funny how things change fate. Or how fate changes things, I guess I should more correctly put it. Your life is governed by those small decisions that you make.
Sure, and I'm sure there are a lot of those turning points to come in your story as we follow it along. I do want to ask you, I'd like to ask every veteran on this show this question, because everybody seems to remember something. You mentioned Pearl Harbor.
Right.
What about that day, December 7th of 41? Do you remember where you were and how you heard that news?
Absolutely. I remember it's like 9/11. Going back all of those years, it was Sunday, obviously, and my dad was working in a garage. I had an old 28 Chevrolet, which was my pride and joy, and I was washing it because I had a date with a girl in the afternoon for a tea dance downtown at the Olympic Hotel. It was a nice day, and my dad turned the radio on, and we were transfixed immediately. The news was just mind-boggling. From that day on, there was a spirit and a strength that grew almost hour by hour, day by day, throughout the whole nation. And the dedication of guys wanting to get involved, wanting to pay the Japanese back for what they'd done was just an overwhelming factor. All our lives were changed that day. And Seattle being on the coast and being on Puget Sound, there were a lot of rumors around that the Japanese were off the west coast of the United States with their carriers and all this. Well, of course, it was all baloney. But along with the mobilization of people going into the service, there was also a tremendous increase in a hurry-up manufacturing effort that, of course, spelled doom for Germany and Japan eventually. I can remember Boeing Field, my little old place where I was interested in light planes. Pretty soon you would see early fighters there, and the Boeing Aircraft Company immediately burgeoned into a huge, huge complex. It was a historical time, and it was a time of romance and adventure. And sadness, total sadness, of course, as the word came back that from kids that were going, particularly the South Pacific, that were involved in the early battles there, and we lost, 3,000 at Pearl Harbor. It was a difficult time. There was a generation of strength, as I said before, that began to build in the people, and the Depression wasn't the problem that it had appeared before. The war now was primary. So a shift in concentration, a shift in optimism, a shift in determination all came in to supplant that feeling of desperation and everything that characterized the Depression.
And you went into the Army Air Corps with the idea that you're going to be a fighter pilot.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. Yeah, it was. I built model airplanes. I drew model airplanes. I read everything, G8 and his Flying Aces in the magazines and books of the time. And flying was really a total obsession with me. The aircraft that were built in the late 30s and early 40s, including the military aircraft, like the Boeing F-4, B-4, double biplane, the early Curtis Hawks, they were just items of beauty. And of course, some of the aircraft during the war achieved that status too, the B-51 Mustang and the Focke Wulf 190.
Yeah,
they were magnificent aircraft.
Well, and you would be around quite a few aircraft, but tell me about that journey. And in your hopes of being a fighter pilot, you got to test out in some of those single-engine planes, right?
Yes. I never flew any fighters, but I ended up as an instructor, a single-engine instructor, after I graduated in April of 1944. I was assigned to a field in Taft, California, as an instructor in basic flight training, and they were just switching over then to the T-6 Texan North American. It was a lovely airplane. It was a lovely airplane to see. It was a lovely airplane to fly, fully aerobatic, lots of power, and it was just short of being a fighter of the North American type. And I loved the airplane. I'd flown BTs, the basic trainers, before, and they were a little logy and a little slower, but didn't have the spunk that the T-6 had. And there are thousands upon thousands of guys who flew that airplane, not only in training, but as instructors, that remember it with a great deal of kindness, even though they went on later to fly late P-40s, P-51s, and P-47s.
And it sounds like you're saying you would have been content to just stay there in Taft and keep training pilots in the T-6.
Yeah, I would have been. It was a great job, but they nipped. I think there were 13 of us that were kind of Peck's bad boys, so to speak, and they shipped us out to Kirtland Field in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to B-24 school. They needed four-engine pilots at the time, so we were picked. Unfortunately, I wanted to get into fighters, but I never made it. From Albuquerque, after we finished our transition there, we moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, to an overseas replacement depot, then down to Miami, Florida, and then we were flown to Natal, Brazil, by PA, Pan American Airways, and C-54s, and we waited there for overseas flights to India and the Middle East. hopped, skipped, and jumped all the way across North Africa to Aden and the Red Sea, on up to India, to a place called Tezgan in the Assam Valley. That's where we ended up, and we were supposed to remain there as C-109 pilots. Now, C-109 was a B-24 that was reconfigured to haul gasoline. They took the four bomb bay guts, so to speak, out of the airplane and filled those with collapsible tanks. And the idea was to fly aviation fuel from the Assam Valley in India to China over the hump. Mm-hmm. And the hump, of course, was romanticized, as it should have been. But in order to qualify these statements that I make, I made only one trip over the hump in what they called the Able route, the north route, which was the heaviest, the highest, and the worst of the routes. So the rest of the times I flew the hump were in routes that were labeled B and C, and they moved progressively farther south as they ran the Japanese fighters out of Burma and that area. We could fly farther south, fly lower, mm-hmm. and the terrain wasn't quite as bad. It was still no walk in the park.
Well, and for those who are uninitiated to this lexicon, when you say the hump, you're talking about the highest mountain range in the world, the
yes.
Himalayas.
Yeah.
So that A route was the highest altitude,
yeah.
or at least the most, the closest to the peaks, those
right.
rocky crags, and those others were lower altitude. And some people don't even realize that the war was going on in this part of the world. We hear so much about Europe and the Pacific, but people forget about the CBI, China, Burma, India,
right.
which is where you were.
Right.
Have you ever gotten some funny looks from people when you tell them where you served?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of them, of course, in this day and age, if I talk to kids, they don't know there was a war in China. In yeah. fact, they're barely aware, many of them, that there was a war of that extent going on at all. And I can understand that. That war was 70 years ago.
Very true.
Time passes and things impact, and the effect of Iraq and Iran and 9/11 and all have oriented the kids toward different wars and different times,
mm-hmm.
as it should be,
mm-hmm.
as it should be. It's wonderful to be remembered for having been where I was when I was there. I love that. But those times are gone. There were times of romance. There were times of tremendous adventure, of heavy sadness. Lost a lot of friends.
Because the work you did was at times quite dangerous. We're going to hear more about it when we come back from our first break. You can find photos of Ted and info about his book online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.